Hi, this is Tony Robbins. Welcome to the Power Talk interview portion. And today I'm fortunate enough to be home, which I never get to do these interviews in. And I have the privilege of being with a man that I'm sure you heard of. His name is Dr. Stephen Covey. And I've been an admirer of Stephen's for many years. I feel like he is a force for good in the business community, and I think in our culture as a whole. He's one of those unique individuals that talks about honor and human dignity and character and who really lives it. And I have tremendous respect for you, Stephen, and I couldn't be more thrilled to have you be here.
Thank you very much, Tony. It's good to be in your humble abode.
Well, thank you.
We just call it home.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. I want to make sure people know a little bit more about you, those maybe who haven't heard of you. You're the author of the national best-selling book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And what I love about you, personally, is that you're about one of the most congruent human beings that I know. And that's one of the things I value most. Your caring and your compassion and your desire to help people remember that they're not a stimulus response being, but that they can choose the way to live. And that their need for contribution and interdependence, those themes I think are so important in our society today, and that honor is more important than things like moods or temporary desires. I've really tried to base my work on principles, values. You do the same. So I'd like to get into those, but I think before we do anything else, what I'd love to do, if you'd be willing to allow us, is find out more about your background. What made you decide to become a professor, and then how did that evolve into the 7 habits?
Well, when I did my undergraduate and then I did my mission work, I became very interested in training, developing leaders. So when I went to the Harvard Business School, I focused on the human side in the second year, where you were given a lot of electives. And then I thought that teaching had high leverage opportunities, so I started to teach at the Brigham Young University, and I taught there for about 5 years. And then I went on another mission to Ireland for 3 years, and then I came back, went into the administration of Brigham Young University, then back into teaching after a period of time. And then I decided I would really like to make an impact on the world. So I kind of distilled the essence of what I'd been learning working with organizations and people over a period of, I guess, about 20 years into the concept that private victories always precede public victories.
Yes.
And that out of true, deep character strength lies the power of both courage and compassion. And to me, the unique juxtaposition of courage and compassion is the essence of the foundation of an interdependency in the world. And so I became enamored by that idea, and I got into it, and I began to think, now, what would help produce, see, this private victory? Well, to take responsibility for your own life. So that's habit one, see?
Right.
And then, well, what is your life about? That's habit two.
Right.
And then to live by it, that's habit three. So in a sense, those three kind of fundamental ideas comprise the foundation for the private victory. Now, what's the public victory? Well, it's that you essentially regard other people with great respect and dignity and treat them accordingly. And how do you solve problems then? You have to listen to them first before you seek to be listened to. And then you try to go into synergy, which means you create something that is better than what either proposed initially. And out of those three represent the essence of the public victory, or the essence of interdependency, which is what life is, see? So then I started working with that material. You know how it goes as you go out training, you get a lot of feedback and you hone the material.
And then you figure out how to keep that by reinforcing it through the,
right?
the whole idea of sharpening the saw.
Right, and sharpening the saw, that's habit seven. So then I decided, but I don't want to just be a speaker. I really want to get this thing institutionalized, and I want to see it has carry-on value, see,
right,
to really impact lives. So that's why I left BYU and went into setting up a business, and takes us where we are today, I guess.
Well, we have very similar goals. I had the same things that shaped me. I looked at people doing speeches, and I thought, you know, how long will the impact last? And as you know, building an organization requires a little bit more energy and impact and focus than just going out and doing the speeches, but it gives you the opportunity to continue to touch people.
The real key I have found is to train people inside their own organizations.
Yeah. Their own champions, if you would.
Yes, so that they then start teaching others, who in turn teach others, practice it, report back on their experiences in both teaching and applying, so that they start to get a sense of responsibility toward the material and accountability.
And momentum.
It does. It does create a momentum. There's a natural momentum of enthusiasm because it actually impacts lives. So when people come back, they say, what did you do? Well, I tried this circle of influence idea, and I just focused only on the things that I could work on. I can't tell you what that did to my marriage, or what it did with this teenage son that I've had nothing but headaches with.
Yes.
Or what it did in my executive team. Then they report, really? Well, it didn't work with me. Why did you do it? And they learn from each other. It becomes a kind of synergistic learning environment. So that, in a sense, my speech maybe was a catalyst to start it off. But in all sincerity, the power is when they do it with themselves.
Yes, I agree.
One of the little things I use in my presentations is a compass. And I ask people at the beginning of the speech to point north, to close their eyes and point north. And usually about 30-40% actually have it correct. But that's the way it is with most people in most organizations. They really don't know where true north is. Yeah. Then I say, well, true north, you notice, is an external reality. That's what principles are. See, values are internal. Principles are external. And the key is to get our value system, which is the arrow of the compass. I gradually show that the compass never changes. True North never changes. But our value system is manifested in our habit patterns, and in an organization they're called our practices, is to get into alignment with True North or with principles. Then you get in harmony with the laws of nature.
Yes.
You get in harmony with what Carl Jung called the unconscious, the collective unconscious that pervades all humanity, regardless of their upbringing, their religion, their cultural heritage, their scripting, whatever it is, there is something far more basic and generic at that level than most people know about. And I find that no matter where we go in developing mission statements, if you get enough people interacting freely, feeling safe in the interaction, and where they're really synergistic, you know, where they're learning from each other, and also when they're very informed on the full nature of the problems in their situation, all the mission statements become the same. They all know where True North is.
So in what way?
They all basically describe not the vision part of the mission statement, what their enterprise is about, but the principles part of the mission statement always basically deals with four things: our physical being and our economic well-being, see. So the principle there is fundamentally to be fair toward people. And then the social part, that is having to do with relationships and the creation of a culture that has what I call an immune system in it, so we can handle any problems that come down the pike, and has this great ability to solve problems regardless. The principle there has to do with how you treat people. Kindness and dignity and so forth, and respect. You see people as a separate individual of equal worth to yourself. Then the third area they always deal with, inevitably, is how do you develop people? That's the psychological nature. How do you identify their talents? Then how do you develop them? Then how do you use them? That's the missing area in this country in most organizations, is how to use people's talents.
Yes.
The top people are being used, but the many other levels are not empowered at all. And that's why we have such a hard time competing in a global marketplace against major organizations from the Far East and from Europe that are more fully using people's capacities and talents. Then the fourth area has to do with, you know, what's it all about, Alfie? It's the spiritual nature. That is, are you making a difference? Do you really make a contribution? Do you add value? Does your life matter? In my next project I'm working on, I'm essentially bringing this together, and I'm calling it The Fire Within. You'd like that.
Yeah,
the Fire Within, to live, see, to live, to love, to learn, to leave a legacy. Wow. Trying to show how the four basic needs. And then I'm going to try to show how that pertains to every individual, every organization, and every society.
Fantastic. Tell me, you know, one of the major frames of reference that have shaped you is the whole concept of paradigms. Understanding that rather than just trying to change a behavior or a strategy or a single value, to really change the entire system, the entire way of looking at life, the entire belief systems. It's one of the things that we share in common. It's one of the things a lot of our graduates who are listening have experienced through Date with Destiny, a program that we do to make that kind of change happen. What I'm really getting towards is, in the beginning of your book, you shared about one of your children and how your experience with that child helped you to understand how your paradigm was affecting your children. Maybe we could touch on that.
Yeah, that's a key area. In fact, when I wrote the Seven Habits book, our common editor said, you need a grabber there at the beginning.
Yeah.
Some personal experience. And I hesitated to do it. Got my son's kind of struggled out approval to do it. But basically, this was a boy who was in his junior high period of time, and he was kind of backward and awkward and didn't do well in school. He didn't even know how to take tests. He socially seemed to be out of it. Athletically, he was a complete uncoordinated kind of klutz.
And how'd you really feel about it?
And my wife and I would sit and talk with each other about this kid, you know, like, what have we got on our hands? It's the, I often say to audiences, the key to your family is how you treat the child that tests you the very most.
Yes.
Because, you see, that's the only child that really tests your own character.
Yeah.
And develops your own character at its outward edge, plus enables the other children to know your love is unconditional.
Yeah.
Well, this boy was putting us through those paces. And we were trying to use what I call the personality ethic, you know, to use a lot of visualization, affirmations, and to get him psyched, and to, you can do it, son, believe you can, come on, hold the bat this way, and then when they pass the ball, throw the ball to you, you just keep your eye on it, and then swing, you know, and then he'd swing before the ball was pitched, and his brothers would just fall apart with laughter, and then I'd get on their backs to get off his back, see, I mean, you can imagine the kind of social dynamic that was taking place. Essentially, the same kind of thing was happening socially and academically. Well, one time I was back in Armonk, New York, with IBM Executive Development Headquarters, talking on the self-fulfilling prophecy and the concept that the perception or the paradigm you have of the world causes your behavior to behave in a certain way, which produces the evidence to support your perception or your paradigm.
Sure.
It's the self-fulfilling prophecy, and when I was teaching it one day, I thought, is it possible this is true with my son, that the problem is not in my son at all? It's in the way I am seeing him and in the way that I am seeing what the growth process should be for him. See, the difference between training and development, or what's called education, is that training is something you do from the outside. In education, it means to draw out of.
Right.
See, we were into a training process, training our boy. We weren't in an education process at all. We didn't deeply affirm the essential essence of his being and his own timetable. In a sense, we were pressing the nervous definition of society and its timetable upon his growth process, see?
And reinforcing for him that he wasn't enough, in essence, unconsciously, were you not?
Right, we were, and then he was producing the evidence to validate our perception and his perception.
Pygmalion at its best.
It is, and yes. And what happened was that we would protect him from his brothers, and he liked that protection. He got to like it. The whole spirit of codependency that is so popular in the recovery literature today started to get into us. Well, anyway, I began to say to myself, you know, physician, heal thyself. What are you out here teaching this stuff for? And you've got a situation, maybe you yourself have to work. So I talked with Sandra about it.
It's your wife.
My wife, and it was a very kind of difficult experience. It was the toughest part, really, is for the two of us to honestly admit that maybe the problem was in our paradigm, and maybe that paradigm was a product of our own motive structure. That's why I really believe that we lead three lives: our public life, you know, where we're with each other, and our private life, where we go when we go home, we may watch television, or we may read, or we may visit with our loved ones, or so forth. But this key life is the secret life. That's where you go into your heart and examine your motives. What are you really about? And what are you going to align your life to, see? So Sandra and I began to say, really, what is our motives? And we sensed that we were trying to, in a sense, get some, I don't know, social mileage, see? Mm-hmm. Other people to like us, because in the kind of business that you and I are in, people are always looking and observing, and mm-hmm. I kind of like it when people say, wow, what fine children you have. You know what I mean?
It
builds you up a little, and but we came to feel that's a totally unworthy motive.
Yeah.
It's not a sufficient motive.
Yeah.
So we worked internally on ourselves, into our own secret life, as it were, and we commingled our secret life. I think commissioning basically means is co-missioning, commingling the missions of people. And yes. Sandra and I found that it was enormously deepening of our relationship to have that experience with this boy. And you know what? We just started to relax and to affirm him and to kind of let go of the kind of social timetable of society, and we let go of our tendency to clone him or to do our thing on him or to train him or to do what I call the personality ethic on him. We just affirmed his worth and value. Initially, he had a hard time because he liked the way we would protect him, but we saw him differently. Yeah. We saw him as a person who had fundamental adequacy. And he started to grow, and in a very rapid way started to grow in all these different dimensions. And even though he achieved real success athletically and academically and socially, that no longer became the overriding criteria. We wouldn't say to ourselves, oh, good, it worked. You don't do something because it works. You do it because it's right. It's principle-based. And principles are natural laws, and they're going to govern regardless. Like it or not, they're going to have their way. So he started to, all of a sudden, achieve more feeling of his own worth and independence. He brought home a straight A-plus report card with one A on it, which means he'd done extra assignments in all those classes. And his brothers looked at that and said, what is that? Whose is that? No, that's your brother. Oh, come on now, really, what's going on here? We said, no, it really is. And he said, well, is he some kind of a genius? And I said, yes, he is. We don't know what kind, but he's got something that's very unique and powerful.
It's pretty important for people to believe that about everyone, I think, don't you?
I think so. I really think so. In fact, he was our fifth child. That affected our relationship with the other four that were still yet coming along.
Yeah.
And now it's affected our relationship with our older children and their children. Yeah. I really believe when we raise our children, we are raising our grandchildren. And that you need to see what you're doing because it's going to carry on into the next generation.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean if people aren't proactive enough, they can't overcome bad scripting.
Right.
But if you can create the optimum environment for positive scripting, you know, how much more advantage?
Well, I have to rework the system.
Right.
That's neat. That's fabulous. One of the things I didn't get in my question with you is one of the things you did is you researched as part of, I guess it was your master's degree, was it?
It was a doctoral program.
A doctoral program.
Right.
You researched, what, 200 years of the success literature?
Of the success literature in this country. It was a fascinating study. In fact, I got into it almost by accident. It was a literature review because my dissertation dealt with what difference does introducing the moral element in training have, and I used an empirical approach, good scientific design, comparing how the moral approach would affect the net result compared to one that was totally technical and didn't deal with the moral dimension at all. Well, I decided to do some research into the different areas, and eventually it took me into the study of all the success literature in this country going back to its founding, 1776. And I became so interested and fascinated by it that it affected my whole life. What I learned was the first 150 years in this country's history, the focus was almost exclusively on what you could call the character ethic. That means the kinds of things we're talking about here, industry and courage and fidelity and charity and integrity, all the good character traits that you know and that all societies, all religions essentially teach.
The north-pointing principles of life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
True north.
Right.
Then around World War I and the movement away from the ground, see the agricultural ethic, which teaches you there's no shortcut. And as you start to move toward the industrial age, you start to learn the political way of thinking so you can psych out the systems and use your own intelligence to figure how to get what you want in the least costly way and so forth. Plus,
That's really fascinating. The ground being the metaphor.
It is.
I imagine that still shapes a lot of the cultures, the Midwestern values that are still very strong in this country. And you go to a place like various parts of Russia, and you see that total connection with the ground still, and values. That really rings true in my experience as well. That's fascinating.
It is. You see the law of nature,
yeah.
The law of the harvest.
Yeah.
You always reap as you sow.
Yeah.
And then gradually it shifted into what you might call the personality ethic.
Right.
Which tended to take three tracks, I found. One is the track of PR, that is, how to create the image about yourself.
Right.
That may, in a sense, compensate for the lack of substance. Right. The other one...
Temporarily,
is,
maybe.
Yeah, it's temporary. Yeah. Well, politicians, you know, the soundbite and the... And just the image that is associated with a dominant emotion that ties into people's values. I think that's the key political strategy. And and if the people know how to do that little formula, then maybe they don't have to have it in fact, see? So the other one is the human relations philosophy. And I was taught this philosophy at the Harvard Business School just at the time when it started to shift into the human resource philosophy, which Japan really has accelerated in an extremely rapid clip. And most of my professors and teachers were people that showed the people have social needs, they have emotional needs, and you just cannot treat them as a stomach, someone that you can manipulate with the carrot and stick, the great jackass theory of human motivation. You really have to create an environment and treat them right and so forth.
Yes.
But that concept became filled with a whole technology that went with it, how to push the right button, pull the right lever, and you do this and this, and it causes people to get into social styles theory, learning styles theory, so they learn how to put people into quadrants. Then they don't have to figure out how to deal with people.
You have to treat them as people.
Right? Yeah, you treat them as a thing.
It's like a computer, them, you know.
Exactly.
You know.
You got them categorized.
Yeah.
You got them figured out, see.
Yeah.
I don't have to deal with you now, but I don't have to be open. I don't have to be vulnerable.
I also don't have to think.
Yeah, I don't have to think because I have my set kind of patterns of how you deal with people like this. And it also reinforces prejudgment or prejudice toward sex, race, and class, usually the three most common kinds. Then you can immediately categorize. See, I don't have to deal with people then. Also, you don't have to deal with your wife based on only yesterday. You don't have to rediscover your wife today or your child and see them in entirely new light.
Nor do you have to question some of your own beliefs. Because if you begin to appreciate someone else, invariably you ask questions. If they have different beliefs or paradigms, you have to begin to question some of your own. And that's a scary thing for a lot of people.
Yeah, I had not, that's good. So that if you start to move out of categories, you have to start looking at your own categories.
That's correct.
And if your security lies in those categories, it's like an ego enema.
Could you be more graphic in your metaphor? That's good, Stephen. I don't know if I'll use that one in a public place, but maybe I will. It's pretty, it'll get your attention. That's great. But you hear what I'm saying?
I think that's
the process.
I think that see, that's what I call a thing paradigm versus a people paradigm.
Yes, yes.
So that's another field. The other area is the whole field of PMA, the positive mental attitude.
Yes.
The original founding, as you know, came really out of the scriptures and Mary Baker Eddy's interpretation of the scriptures. And then if you study the great gurus at the beginning of the movement, these were people who had the principles deep within them. Yeah. When their disciples started to pull away from the character side of that and to embellish and to enlarge this whole area of visualization, affirmation. In other words, how to better manipulate your own mind like you did people.
Yeah.
See, so this literature review got me into literally thousands of sources, and I just became so interested and absorbed, and it convinced me I want to become part of restoring the character ethic.
Yeah.
Because you can see what's happened to our society, how the social problems are deepening and worsening, and they're multiplying to such an extent that they will overwhelm the economic machinery in this country and discombobulate all of life. And unless we can tap into enough of that conscience power and the idealism of people who will be more of a volunteer to help schools and to help communities and so forth, that's why I think everyone should always have some role every week where they do service in their church. They should do it, but also in community and in their schools and with the kids that have never had good scripting at all.
Yeah.
I think the key to our own children is to adopt their friends. If they have any difficulty, adopt them. Raise their friends.
Wow,
raise
what a
many,
great
many
principle.
People.
I love that.
You can influence so many other families.
Only a man with 9 kids would think this way. That's wonderful.
Well, it makes your life like Grand Central Station, but...
Yeah.
Also,
the rewards are just unbelievable.
Well, that, and the children get the sense of our life is not for pleasure and fun.
Yeah.
Our life is to contribute and to serve.
Yeah. And your children, like anyone else, they model what you do, not what you say. Interesting.
I often say to audiences, you know, how many crammed and people acknowledge, and they say, that's a value system. Now, how many have ever worked on a farm? And they say, well, there's usually a small percentage. I say, for more than a year, that's a smaller percentage. But I say, did you ever cram on the farm? You know, forget the plant, flake off all summer, then hit it real hard in the fall to bring in the harvest, you know, and the audience usually kind of breaks up with that because see how ludicrous it is? Yeah. See, they know in their consciences already. So then I say, okay, now tell me what's business like, farm or school.
Oh,
and they always are torn a little on that. So I say, let me get more specific. Long-term business. And you know what everyone says like this? Farm.
Yeah.
Short-term business, school. Marriage, farm. Raising teenagers, hard farming. back the other day down in Australia, someone screamed out, prison farming.
I don't know if that's the most empowering metaphor. Oh, that's
but
funny.
See, people know. They right? know the difference between values and principles.
You know, if you don't plant in the spring, you're going to weep in the fall.
Right.
Oh, that's right. That's interesting. Oh, gosh. I think so many of the problems of society, and I'm curious if you agree with me on this, have come from the fact that the paradigms of society have changed so rapidly that people have begun to believe that there are no rules. And the rules have changed continuously, supposedly, societal rules anyway. And as a result of that, I think that people, that's where the disturbance comes from, because we all need some form of guidance. Do you agree with that, disagree with that?
Well, I think that is what discombobulates people's lives,
yeah.
is because the changing rules.
Yeah.
But when you orient to principles, which
forever.
Are totally apart from society, you have a changeless core inside yourself that enables you to accommodate all those changes. In fact, not just to accommodate with them, but to run with them.
Yes.
And to optimize the opportunities which those changes bring about. Because down deep inside, it is changeless.
Yeah.
And that's one of the points I try to get across with businesses, because as you know, one of the major challenges is just this dizzying rate of change. And
yeah.
if businesses can get a core set of principles plus a common shared vision and call that their mission statement or their constitution, and if that is truly impregnated throughout the entire culture and people are socialized into it, trained into it, nurtured into it, what happens is that you're creating the soul of the organization.
Yeah.
And if it's based on True North principles, it'll never change.
Yeah.
Those True North principles are going to operate regardless.
Yeah.
So then you can see
products
how you
will change, environments will change, but the people and their mission won't change.
Right.
And that's what holds it all together and makes it grow.
And if you don't have that, you know where people get their security? From their structures and their systems.
Mm.
That's why.
Which reinforces the inability to change.
It does, because it makes the whole organization
inflexible.
Ill-adaptive.
Yeah.
It can't flex.
Now, people's identity becomes tied to a structure or a set of responsibilities instead of to principles.
They do, and to these rules, then it gives them their predictability in life. See, I can predict it, it's dependable, but then life isn't like that. So unless they start to internalize these, and unless you get the whole culture to internalize it, you're going to have bureaucracy and you can't get rid of it. I'll tell you what worries me the most about polarizing politics, you know, it separates people,
right.
is that it undermines trust.
Yeah.
And when trust is undermined or the emotional bank account gets overdrawn, you cannot change bureaucracy.
And that's where we are a great deal, at least in the political system currently.
It is. And they all claim they want to get rid
system.
Of the bureaucracy. I mean, we have so many programs that essentially are obsolete in their function but not in their funding.
Yes.
And the reason they can't change it is that you don't have the spirit of peacemaking. You don't have the spirit of synergy. You have the spirit of dichotomizing and separating and contention and adversarialism and legalism and suism. Everyone's suing everybody,
no,
see?
It's out of control. No personal responsibility.
Well, that's right. Everyone's a victim. They're all blaming someone else. But then how are we ever going to get synergy? See, unless you have synergy and an internalization of a common shared value system, they instead get their security from their structures and their systems. And they're going to keep those rigid and strong. And this effort of educational reform, political reform, business reform cannot go except upon the foundation of trust. And trust is based on the foundation of trustworthiness. You can't talk yourself out of problems you behave yourself into. And any effort...
I love that. I love that. I've heard you say that
Yeah,
before.
Any effort to do so is back into those personality ethic technologies. And I'm not against, by the way, the personality ethic. I believe in it. As long as it comes congruent on the foundation of the character ethic. I believe in PR and human relations techniques and visualization affirmation very, very strongly.
We're trying to build with no foundation falls to
the floor.
That's
the whole
point. Yeah. One of the human paradoxes, though, I think, and I'm curious what your view of this is that this such a strong need for certainty, which principles provide, yet at the same time, too much certainty, and people seem to be bored. Now, I don't think that's true when it comes to principles, but do you know what I'm saying? People are all out there trying to figure out, oh, they'll have enough certainty if they just know their job will be a certain way, enough certainty if I can just get this relationship, enough certainty if my kids can just get straightened out, enough certainty if, and you hear people talk about all these ways that they're trying to gain certainty, yet if you were totally certain about everything, when, how, who, et cetera, you'd be bored out of your mind. Everybody loves a surprise. How do we resolve the paradox?
Well, as I see it, those people are not principle-centered.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
What they are is they're trying to get certainty in their environment. They're trying to get certainty into their relationships. If they were truly principle-centered, it would create such an optimum looseness and flexibility and adaptability at the edges of their entire life that serendipitous events would happen constantly. Happy surprises would happen constantly. The spirit of variety, the spirit of adventure would be nurtured continuously because in a sense, once you have a sense of stewardship and you're principle-centered, you don't know how you're going to be used. You don't know what's going to happen in your life, whose lives you'll have an opportunity to bless.
So you live in a state of expectancy, positive expectancy.
Absolutely. You're extremely open, and life becomes such an adventure, and you're not saying, if only I could finish this, see, because you're not goal-driven, you're not schedule-driven.
Right.
Goals become part of the tools, you set up a schedule, but you're principle and people-driven, not schedule-driven, and that's why left-brain people who are using left-brain, say, management or time management tools, they'll find themselves essentially coming, you know what I say, you lean your ladder against the wrong wall. They get to the top rung. No one on their deathbed ever wished they'd spent more time at the office.
Right.
By the way, I studied this, the deathbed literature, some of it. I haven't done it systematically like I did the success literature. But literally, I saw a summary of the deathbed literature, and the basic message was all they talked about were relationships and contributions.
Yeah.
They didn't talk at all about things that are so important in day-to-day living.
That makes so much sense. And we all want something that's lasting. Now, if all we do is turn within and look at what those lasting elements truly are, everybody knows what they are. You don't have to be taught those things. Although I think it's great to be coached like anything, and I think that's what hopefully you do and what I attempt to do is really give people some of that coaching. Just get them to remember what they know is true. Socrates said learning is remembering. Earlier on, you were relating to this whole idea of trust, and I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it's the foundation for relationship, and being able to trust yourself, I think, is the foundation for being able to have a sense of self-esteem and know that when you give your word to yourself, you're going to follow through. It's so important. But there's a great metaphor you use, and I've used it in a different way, this emotional bank account. And I think I'd really appreciate if you'd share it here, because I think it would empower people a great deal.
Okay. I like the metaphor, too, because it's kind of a shorthand way of thinking about a huge subject.
Yeah.
And it's like a financial bank account into which people can make deposits. And if they build up enough deposits, they can take withdrawals and they still have reserve capacity. So also in relationships, if people have established a kind of pattern with other people where they treat them based on their commitments, they make and they keep promises, they treat them with respect and kindness, you know what they do initially is they always are empathically listening from within their frame of reference, because you really don't know what a deposit is to another until you listen from within their frame of reference. Because what you think is a deposit to your spouse, to your child, may be a withdrawal to the other.
Yeah.
Everyone sees the world in such a unique way. It's so subjective a reality. That's also part of the spirit of adventure you're talking about, of serendipity, of happy surprises. And
discovery.
That is discovery and adventure inside another person's life, because you're not living out of your own paradigm anymore.
Yeah.
You're living out of other people's and how they see the world. And that is very exciting.
It expands everything in your life.
It gives you the foundation to know what deposits are, too.
Yeah.
A couple of the key elements I find in the emotional bank account is to always be loyal to those who are not present.
Hmm.
I never heard my parents badmouth. ever.
Wow.
And I never heard them, even in kind of, oh, superficial ways, do it. If a person wasn't there, I wouldn't talk about them. I was a visiting professor in Hawaii one time, and I was complaining to the president of the university about the lousy housing situation that was in violation of the agreement, you know, and it had been set up. And in a sense, I went into his office, you know, just fix this guy for me, will you, president? And the president said about his housing director, what a fine man he is. But I hear what you're saying, Stephen, and I share your concern. Why don't we have him come over, and then let's work on this thing together. I'll never forget what I went through as the man was coming across campus to get to the president's office. I said to myself, you know, maybe I'm partly responsible for this. Maybe the miscommunication has taken place, and I wasn't clear in my expectations. And, you know, and, oh, here I came in to just kind of have the president just manipulate things with all of his power, see. But here is a man who respects people, who will not, behind their back, badmouth them. Mm. And participate in something that would make him popular with me, see? Mm. And I thought,
man of principle.
Oh, a man of principle. So when that man arrived at the office, I mean at the president's office, I said to him, you know, maybe I'm partly responsible. My whole spirit was subdued and humble. And it taught me a powerful lesson, see?
Yeah.
And every time I was around that president or thought about the president, even talking about him now, a sense of respect and honor about what this man represented, see. So that doesn't mean you may not be critical behind someone's back, but you may have to do it in a constructive manner. How can we go to help that person?
Yeah.
How are we going to give feedback to that person?
Rather than a derogatory manner.
Rather than the bashing approach of some quick thing, because the moment you do it with the one, the guy you're with knows full well you'll do it with him behind his back when there's a strain on your relationship.
Plus you'll do it to yourself.
You will. You will.
I want to make sure we touch on the seven principles, and I know you've got a timeline, so I want to get to that. The seven habits of success, actually, we're talking about highly effective people. And I love your definition of effectiveness. Can we touch on that?
I like it because everyone resonates with it.
Yeah.
Just yesterday I was with a group, and I said to a woman there, I said, you're a career woman, and you also have a family. She said, yes. I said, how do you like to have a clean home? She says, well, I just don't, but I like it. I said, well, what would a success be to you? Wouldn't that be to have a clean home, plus that your children do their jobs cheerfully without being reminded? And she thought, she said, oh, yeah, that would be it. I said, that's the definition of success. I use the word effectiveness to get away from the word of success because it tends to connote only getting desired results.
Right.
But you have to constantly nurture the assets that produce those desired results. So if your emotional bank account with your kids are high and you have win-win performance agreements and high trust, then you could have a box where you put money in and say, take your allowance out. And you judge your own performance. I always ask audiences, if trust is high, if the emotional bank account is high, are people easier or harder on themselves?
Yeah.
Always harder. Well, then where do we get the concept of external performance appraisal? You know, the old sandwich technique, say a few nice words, slip in the knife, areas for improvement, twist it a few times, the sandwich technique at the ends. See, it's turning people again into things that you're manipulating. Why not become their servant, their helper, their facilitator, their coach? I think that that is a very powerful definition of effectiveness. And you can apply it in any field of human endeavor, really, in business. If you don't constantly make the deposits into the emotional bank accounts, if you take advantage, let's say, of this, oh, say someone comes into your service station and you can say, oh, look at that starter mortar. Look, you need it. Look at that wire. That's frayed. Really? Well, where's the starter mortar? And you know the guy knows nothing about it. And you take a $20 gas cell to $220. But look what's happened inside. What happened to the attendant that watched you do this thing as he chuckles and laughs with you, see? How does he know you're going to talk about him behind his back?
Yeah.
And then, as Gandhi said, a person cannot do right in one department of life whilst attempting to do wrong in another department. Life is one indivisible whole.
Mm. But let's talk about your formula of effectiveness, because you say there's really a two-step definition. Let's explicitly communicate that. I think that's very powerful.
Okay, now let's say, for instance, that someone had a machine and they wanted to make short-term productivity on this machine. Well, they could run it up, see, and run it night and day, no maintenance. See, they're not taking care of the goose at all. All they're doing is getting more and more golden eggs.
But they probably get acknowledged for it because their productivity went up in the short term.
And they get promoted because, let's say, they're in a they're in a fast-moving, high-growth organization, see, so people are looking where there's some black ink and there's some real profit in this area and this guy's producing like crazy, let's promote him to a higher level. So the next new foreman of the machine comes on. By this time, it starts to break down. So his costs go up and his volume goes down, and he starts writing red ink, gets into losses. Now, what do people say to you about your successor? See, if you were the prior foreman, you know, what a success you were. I mean, how clear it is. I use that story a lot because then I say to audiences, do any of you know this practice? They all identify instantly.
Sure, sure.
People can exploit and liquidate the human resource so rapidly and get more productivity out of it.
But how do you evaluate that? I know it's a pretty giant general question because it probably depends on context, but if there's some principles, some organizing principles on how to evaluate competence as well as character. I think we can feel character.
Yeah, you can feel it, and also I don't think we have the right to, in a sense, invade their character.
Yeah.
I think that the more we write the performance agreement in such a way that it deals with both the goose and the golden egg, that will drive the character ethic through them. Then they choose to go for it. With regard to the competency, there are a lot of tests that can be taken to show people's level of competency and skill. Whether they have interdependency competency, which to me is more important, is a lot tougher to evaluate. The best question I've learned is this one. Start from your earliest life, your earliest remembrances. What is it that you enjoyed doing that you did well? And start with kindergarten, and then you go into first grade, second. How about your junior high? Oh, I see, you liked paper routes, and then you liked to go into playing tennis. You played single tennis. You begin to see a pattern of independency. See, very few people have ever been trained toward interdependency. Engineers aren't. The main problems in engineering companies are interdependency. Doctors aren't. The main problems with HMOs, with hospitals, with group practices, with clinics are problems of interdependencies. Attorneys aren't. Their problems are ones of interdependency, the way they relate to their own partners. As Maslow put it, he that is good with a hammer tends to think everything is a nail.
Yeah.
Educators aren't trained toward interdependency. Well, what are the problems today in education? Interdependency. We have an atmosphere in education that is just like a minefield everywhere, explosions going off, everyone attacking everybody. How are we going to have the foundation on which to bring about educational reform? People have to be trained toward interdependency. I just finished reading three books. You ought to get them. They're powerful. The Good Society, The Soul of Economies, and Breaking Point all bring out, unless you're deep into interdependencies, our institutions, our organizations cannot survive.
But interdependency is the only way you can have synergy, is it not?
By definition, they're almost synonymous. If you're interdependent, you're learning to solve problems synergistically.
Yeah.
If you're not, you're into compromise.
But you know what I think of the word interdependency? Just the word dependency in our culture has so many negative connotations that I think that word keeps people from applying it, whereas synergy has, I think, purely positive connotations for most people.
I think it does, and I think that's a good point. I try to make it explicit what I mean to help define, but nevertheless, those connotations
anchor,
carry.
The anchor keeps coming back up.
It does keep coming back. The problem with synergy is that it does, that there are other aspects to interdependency.
I agree. And synergy does not describe all those
aspects. All those aspects.
Especially the emotional and the relationship
level. But the essence of it is essentially the same. So I like that a lot. I just feel that the movement toward interdependency can start with the little child, where there's a sense of mutual giving. And always ask things of people.
Yes.
Make requests of them. Have them do things for you. Let them experience the joy of sharing and giving.
Yes.
And when they go through kind of the I age of the teenage period is the time to give them the greatest affirmation toward this.
Yes.
And to get them involved in selfless endeavors. I think that kids respond to it.
Yes.
It brings the best out in them. I think our present approaches insult them and their potential, and causes us to live out of our memory toward them instead of our faith in their unseen potential. So We hope to be into 2/3 of the school districts with character education within 5 years.
That's fantastic.
And we're getting it into prisons and into social organizations, into foundations that serve many other organizations. The other day in New York, someone said to all the beneficiary organizations, they give out $250 million a year.
Yes.
They said, the best way for us to help you is not just to give you money, but to teach you principle-centered leadership. They invited me to be the resource speaker. I teach correct principles, see that idea, and people are allowed to govern themselves. And the Far Eastern expression, give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, teach him how to fish, you feed him for a lifetime.
Sure.
So that was the basis. So, and we're getting into Eastern Europe and into Russia, and because the need there is so obvious, people are waiting for things to happen to them, they have to make them happen. So we think we can make a contribution there as well.
That's fantastic. I want to be respectful of your time, and I think I could be here for several days with you, picking from your brain and your emotion and your spirit, and hopefully giving some back. Let's talk about the seven principles, if we may, briefly. Let's talk on starting with habit number one, proactivity. And you don't just talk about proactivity from the standpoint of initiating things. Yeah, you're really talking about understanding what our choices are in life. So can you
right. It basically means that we are not animals. We have a space between what happens to us and our response to what happens to us. Therefore, we can exercise our freedom to use that space. In fact, we have kind of a joke in our family, Tony, you'd be interested in. If anyone starts behaving in a kind of a victimism mentality, you know, and they start blaming someone, or look what someone did on this test to me, and I didn't even, wasn't prepared, someone starts behaving like a monkey. Someone may be doing dishes.
<That's great.
laughs> That, and then if the person
great
doesn't get the message fast, someone else picks it up until literally
the whole family is doing it.
Really, like that, until that person just cracks up. They cannot maintain this victim mentality.
That's right.
So to be proactive means we can choose our response no matter what the circumstance. We can choose our attitude. And all that you teach is really, not all that you teach, but part of what you teach is embodied in that whole idea.
Yeah.
Then habit two, basically, is the principle of what I call the mental or the spiritual creation. That is where you decide what your life is about. That's where you go into your secret life and make your mission statement. And I would really encourage people, pay the price, get still, get into nature, get slow, see it as a process, don't push it, don't try to be efficient with yourself, just like it doesn't work if you're efficient with your spouse or your child. Just be slow, but be determined to decide what your life is about. And then do it with your family. I've done some marriage and family counseling, and the most helpful intervention I know is to help them develop a mission statement. They both were scripted differently, but how do you two want to deal with your problems? What kind of an immune system do you want to have, see?
Yeah.
So habit two at the business level means develop mission statements that embody from the bowels.
Yeah, that's so key, because otherwise if the executives...
It can't come from Mount Olympus.
Reality. Yeah.
Now, if it starts at Mount Olympus, then send it out as a first draft and say, we don't like it either, because it doesn't have your input.
Right.
And then listen to the input, be open to it. Yeah. Very few people, it takes high level of maturity to want input when you're convinced you're right. Very few people really want other people's opinions when they're convinced they're right.
Yeah.
Third is to live by it. I call that put first things first. The second is begin with the end in mind. What I do in audiences to teach the first three fast is get them to write the epitaph they'd like to have on their tombstone. Because it immediately gets them into an awareness state. They have to draw on imagination and conscience and explore their willpower. Am I willing to live by this, see?
That's neat.
Someone yesterday said to live the golden rule. So I said, you know what that means? Towards your children, towards your neighbors, toward it. When you're pushed to the hilt, are you prepared to go the distance? When you're alone, when you're in the dark, where your character is truly being tested? That's the true test, see? So that's habit three, is to put first things first. It means to organize yourself and execute around the central priorities of your life.
You had a neat thing I wanted to make sure I interject, because I really loved it, was you said habit number one is realize that you are the programmer. Habit number two is write the program. what are you really about? What are you going to do? What is the ultimate guiding principles? And then habit number three, I don't think you language, but I mean, it's live the program, is
right,
it not?
Live it, or as to use the computer language, it would be run it.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
You're the programmer, write the program, now run it.
Yeah.
You're the architect, write the blueprint, now do the physical construction.
Yeah.
And those first three, done over and over, develop a private victory. Now, that's at the beginning stages. As you get more and more mature, then habit one changes its character.
Define maturity.
Maturity would mean that you have a sense of self sufficient to allow you to be both courageous and considerate.
Hmm.
Many people are very courageous, but they're not really empathic, sensitive, considerate, see, respectful. Many others are respectful, empathic, sensitive, but they don't have any courage, no drive, no standards, no sense of vision.
Is an organizing principle for your life a true north principle, the principle of balance?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
In fact, the time management thrust is on prioritization.
Yeah.
I suggest it should also adopt the principle of balance.
Yes.
And also the principle of principles, because not to get schedule-centered,
but
to be principle-centered and people-focused.
Yeah.
But principle-centered. You don't want to get people-centered, or what if they let you down? You've been devastated.
Talk about the concept of centeredness. I love it. You ran through about a half dozen, if I remember correctly, relationship-centered, spouse-centered, money-centered, possession-centered.
Well, whatever becomes the center of your life, it's like a pair of glasses through which you see all of life. It's like your lens. See, so if you become centered, let's say, on your spouse, what happens when your spouse's weakness is exposed, or your spouse is kind of in a bad mood towards you? It can be devastating to you. Now, what happens if you're principle-centered? Now you can look on the spouse's weakness with compassion and understanding. Why? Your security does not come from how your spouse treats you. Your security comes from your integrity to those principles.
So your center is the primary focus and means that you've designed for your life in order for you to feel like you have a direction, in order for you to feel security and so forth. Is that
security? And guidance, and wisdom, and power.
Okay.
Wisdom means your perspective and your balance. Power means your courage and your compassion, your power to have them both, see?
Where do those come from? What are those focused upon?
Those come from whatever's at the center of your life. If it comes from money, if your money gets lost, then look what's happened to your security.
It's gone.
What's happened to your guidance? You're totally discombobulated. What's happened to your sense of wisdom and balance and perspective? Some people have become enemy-centered. They literally are consumed with the weakness of another person. They'll begin to define their friends as to whether or not they're allies to them toward the enemy.
Yeah.
And if they're not, they'll say, you're my enemy too. People who are work-centered, a lot of people that have gone into multi-level marketing have become so work-centered that they have defined loved ones as customers.
Oh, gosh. Oh, no.
You know, and they go after their loved ones.
So when you say you're principle-centered, what does that mean to you specifically?
Okay, now that means to me specifically that I see life through a set of balanced, organized set of principles.
Tell me some of them, for you personally.
Well, for me personally, they would deal with humility, which involves gratitude.
Yes.
And getting centered upon God, who is the source of all these principles.
Yes.
Second, that comes from that is purity. Purity of motive, purity of thought, and also forgiveness. The necessity of having anything of my past that has been impure, not part of me at all today.
Yeah.
The third is charity. Out of purity comes, I now want to serve and to bless and to contribute. So you get an outward focus.
Yeah.
The fourth is productivity. That is, you have charity, but now you want to make a difference.
Yeah.
You have the feeling, but now, to use your language, you want to become an actor. You want to do something.
Yeah.
It's in action.
Yes.
See? So productivity. The fifth is effectiveness. You don't want to just be productive. You want to get results. So that's a whole different way of thinking than just being active. The sixth is the test always of effectiveness is integrity. Because you can always, you know, get more golden eggs and mess up the goose a little in some way if you're not careful.
Yeah.
Now, what's the test of integrity? It's courage. Because you can get integrity at a low level.
Sure. When it's not a test, it's not really integrity, really.
Yeah, when you don't have to be full of compassion and courage.
Right.
So courage comes in there. Courage, I see, is the quality of every quality at its highest testing point. You know, everything reaches a point of test. That's where you exercise courage.
And that's when you move to the next level.
That's where you move to the next level, exactly. The next one is simplicity. I have a tendency to complicate. So I have to drive myself to focus on high leverage factors. That's why I have an organization. I delegate. Education has been delegated, essentially. I'll come in and give speeches like you're talking about.
Yeah.
But I have a CEO I trust. He's delegated with the responsibility of running the business. I don't want to get my head into business. I want to get my head into ideas and teaching and people. See? So simplicity. Now, that's taken some doing. My wife just can't believe how much I delegate. I'm trying to get her to delegate more.
But you're delegating where you have trust and where you have competence.
Right, and where there's competence and integrity.
Yes.
The two foundations of trustworthiness.
Yes.
Which is the foundation of trust. Then you can move to empowerment. As long as there are systems and structures that are in alignment. Notice the four levels. The personal level is trustworthiness. Interpersonal, trust. Managerial, empowerment. Organizational, alignment. Those are the four principles. Of an organization, of the four levels of an organization.
Yes.
Then I go into what I call temperance, you know, where the way you live so that you're wise and you're judicious and you're careful and the way you take care of your body and your mind and so forth. Then the last three are justice, the whole philosophy of win-win and mutual respect, cheerfulness, so that you're not some heavy-handed preacher that is just into self-righteous and into no fun, no enjoyment, no, you know, all of that, and then wisdom, which is the, these are the kind of the 12 principles I live by.
So by living by those principles, you are better as a father, you're better as a parent, you're better probably in your money, all those areas you talked about other people getting centered in, you're probably more effective in as a result of that, and you can control these. So you've set up a game that's winnable in life instead of a game that's fearful.
They're all in your own circle of influence.
Exactly.
Not one of them.
Clarify that principle.
Okay, that's a key principle.
Yeah, it's very important.
Very important principle, because just try to imagine two circles. An outer circle we could call the circle of concern. Those are all the things you're worried about. Things you can do nothing about, though, necessarily. But there's an inner circle inside that larger circle are concerns that you can do something about. I call that the circle of influence. Always give your energies there. It'll get larger. Most people give their energies to the outer circle. They're filled with victimism and why things don't work and so forth. And the inner circle will get smaller and smaller.
So you keep focusing on what you can do instead of what you can't do. Who you are and what you can deal with gets larger.
Anytime you think the problem is out there, that thought is the problem.
Yeah. Instead of saying, here's what I can do right now today. And if I keep doing this, the outer problems start to disappear.
Now, if people want to test this, I say give it a 30-day test. Just in your home, start with your home, start with your marriage. Stop confessing someone else's sins. Just start producing good things.
Yes.
Don't fight them. If you go home, the place is a mess, just start picking it up cheerfully. Then when you have your family council meeting, organize a way, build a relationship so that others do their part. If you don't have that culture yet, start moving toward it.
Yeah.
Point is, you're always doing something over which you have influence and control.
You have an interesting distinction. You talk about three kinds of problems. Those you have direct control over, those you have indirect control over, and those that you have no control over.
Right.
And can you talk about what you should do with each of these and how you identify which are which?
Those problem areas you have direct control over, such as yourself, then you learn to change yourself. Those that you have indirect control over, that is with other people, you try to use different methods to influence them. And there are many, many methods. If one method doesn't work, you don't give up on the person.
Right.
You think of another method. Maybe you haven't listened to them enough. Maybe you have to do some more changing before. Maybe you have to make more deposits. You can't just expect if you're $100,000 overdrawn on the emotional bank account, you take your child on some camping trip for one weekend and make a $5,000 deposit. It's going to cause your child to get on the right track. Now you're only $95,000 overdrawn. So you have to be very, very patient and understanding. With regard to notion control type problems, you learn to change your attitude. You smile about it. You live with it.
Yeah.
It's like the AA prayer.
Yeah. So we've gone deep on this process. I asked you about, you know, the principles and the idea of what you're centered on, and that was coming out of what we were talking about in terms of the third principle. Let's go back to the fourth habit that you teach.
Okay. One more word on the first, okay?
You sound pretty much proactive. Like me.
And
just
that is,
one more thing.
That is, every one of these habits at a higher level is manifested differently. For instance, to be proactive at the higher level would be to learn to forgive.
Yes, yes.
Okay, let's go to the fourth.
Let's review the first three now.
The first three, be so proactive.
Remember, simplicity is one of the principles. Right?
I know. What do you expect me to live what I teach?
No, I don't expect that. So number one is
okay,
proactive.
Number one is to be proactive.
And that means,
to
again,
take responsibility, you're the programmer.
Great.
Number two, begin with the end in mind, basically means write a mission statement before you think of goals. Create the context for what your life is about, both principles and vision.
And that could be as simple as a page that is they put thought into and that they're going to continue to improve over the course of their life. True?
Right.
Okay. Third?
Exactly. I noticed that Schwarzkopf was asked, what would you like on your epitaph? He said, a good soldier who served his country and loved his family. Now, if you analyze that one sentence, it contains many values. Okay, the third is to put first things first. That's where the discipline and the commitment to live by the second comes. If you're building a house, every day you go into that blueprint shed and you study it and get your marching orders for the day.
Right.
Okay, now the first three represent the private victory. The consequence of the first three is totally amazing. You develop an abundance mentality, which means you're not threatened by other people.
Yeah.
You naturally, you don't see life as a zero-sum game, like there's a big piece of pie. See, most people were raised on the basis of being compared to other people.
Yeah.
So they have a hard time being even happy for their success of their own brother or sister.
Yeah.
They might say, I'm happy for you, my friend, but inwardly they're eating their heart out because they see life as a piece of pie.
Scarcity
someone
model.
Gets a hunt. It's a scarcity model.
Yeah.
What happens when you become principle-centered? You get focused upon the fact that life is not scarce. There's abundance. It's endless. There's no such thing.
And it's eternal.
And it is eternal. That's the power of what we're doing here. The development of people is an eternal kind of activity.
Yeah.
And also, it's universal. It pertains to your family, your kids. That's what's marvelous about our professional type work.
Yeah.
The fourth, to think win-win, is a way of expressing life as abundance. Don't see life as a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
The moment someone sees it as competition, you see it as cooperation. Just start behaving that way. How do you behave that way? Habit five.
Well, if I can mention something, real competition is cooperation because the word competition in Latin means to conspire together.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah.
To conspire together.
Yeah. So if I'm going to go out and play basketball with you, I'm going to play full on. And I'm hoping you're doing the same thing with me so that we push each other to another level.
That's great.
Because some people, I think, try to avoid the competition model because they see competition as being win-lose instead of seeing competition organized properly as win-win. And before you dump the other principle, something you taught me that I thought was really interesting was that there are times when the model of win-win isn't necessarily the right model specifically in a context. Can you clarify that before I take it?
Well, for instance, you wouldn't want to compete with your wife.
Right.
You wouldn't want to compete with your kids. If your kid starts taking you on, you don't want to get into an ego battle with
that
child. You wouldn't want to compete in an executive team. You may want to have interaction and synergy and disagreement to produce the decision. Once that decision is made, you don't want to sit and torpedo it.
Right.
You don't want to cause competition inside the workplace. Where competition has its place is the marketplace and the sports arena.
How do you see it in the marketplace being valuable, for example?
Well, I think it's the essence of our free enterprise system
because
they both are trying to win better for the customer.
Right.
And what happens, the customer benefits and you get sharper and your competitor gets sharper to win better for the customer and it lifts the whole economy.
So that's the ultimate conspiring together.
I like it a lot. And we have certain rules of fair play.
Yes.
Sportsmanship and so forth so that you conspire together within the guidelines there.
That's right.
People start piling on or something of this nature, then they will violate the very fabric that enables competition to become, like you say, conspiring together, a very synergistic, healthy thing in our economy.
Let's go to number five, so I'd stop
interrupting. Okay, number five, of all the things we do, is the most requested. It's interesting. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. See, most people listen with the intent to reply, not with the intent to understand.
Yes.
They really are not transcending their autobiography. They're listening maybe attentively, or they pretend to listen, or they listen selectively.
Yes.
that is, oh yeah, that reminds me, let me tell you this, and so forth. Yes. But to really listen empathically means that you get inside the head of another. Not that you agree at all. In fact, that isn't even the issue. It's that you understand. Agreement and disagreement is an irrelevant issue altogether. Once you understand, it's giving people psychological air. It's the ultimate affirmation of another person because you're saying, I value you. I value your world, your perceptions, your feelings. Not that I agree or disagree, that's not even an issue. I value you. What ultimate affirmation. Mm-hmm. That's psychological air to a person. Suck the air out of a person's room. All they want is air. Once they have air, it ceases to motivate them. Similarly, if you empathize truly, deeply, sincerely, consistently, you give people air, they stop fighting you. The defenses are lowered. They start getting into habit six, synergy. Yeah. New ideas, new insights are produced, where the whole is truly greater than the sum of the parts.
And where you have synergy, though, you make a very important point I want to make sure we get across, and that is you have to value differences.
Oh, yes, because in the difference lies the strength. Mm. If we were all perfect and had all qualities, we wouldn't need to value differences. But because we are imperfect and we lack qualities and we all act on an insufficiency of data, it is absolutely imperative that we value these differences. Because if we truly value, I value yours and yours with me, we create something new. We've had touches of that even in our interview today. And I might say, I've been interviewed probably hundreds of times, like, you know, you are by the media and so forth. You're the best interviewer I've had.
Well, thank you.
Because you have your questions are thoughtful, and because you really are trying to listen, and it tends to bring the best out of your guests. And maybe others have told you that, but
maybe it's because I love my guests too.
Well, I think that the synergy, almost every great class, you probably find it in your teaching, hinges on the edge of chaos. You don't know, it's just a brief edge, and all of a sudden a dynamic occurs that is truly serendipitous.
Yes.
It's so exciting.
Yes.
And also, you know what it is? It's the essence of bonding.
Yes.
You can have an experience that's good with another person, but it's when you created something with the other person that wasn't there, that's what bonds you.
Yes.
If parents would learn that with their kids.
Yes.
I had a friend who had a terrible relationship with his son, and I was trying to get across the point to him. What is important to your son must become as important to you as your son is to you.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, all that my son cares about is baseball. Do you have to make that important to me? I said, what is important to your boy must be as important to you. He literally took the summer, visited every major baseball club.
Wow.
And saw him play.
Wow.
And the son moved right through that phase.
Wow.
He wasn't arrested in that phase, fighting for his identity as an integrity. When he came back, we asked the father, did you like baseball that much? No, but I love my boy that much.
Wow.
And what a powerful bonding experience.
Wow.
That was. That doesn't mean you get involved in drugs if they're involved in drugs. You don't want to violate your
thanks
principles.
Thanks for clarifying that.
You don't want to violate your principles.
Yes.
Point
yes.
is, you value that person, see?
Yes.
Well, habit seven is the habit of nurturing the other six on a consistent basis. It has to do with our four dimensions, the physical, the mental, the spiritual, and the social-emotional. And it's sharpening the saw. It comes from the story of someone, what are you doing, sawing down the tree? Well, how long have you been sawing down that tree? Oh, hours. I bet you're tired. Oh, I'm so beat up. Why don't you sharpen the saw? Too busy sawing, dum-dum. It's like too busy driving to get gas, you know. It's just utter foolishness. It's the, what I call the performance capability side or the goose side of all of the other habits.
Yeah.
Where the other habits, in a sense, are the egg side. This nurtures it regularly.
So busy trying to produce the result you're not doing what could help you get the result more consistently and more efficient. Wow. Let me ask you a question. I'm fascinated by something else. You are in great shape. You told me that you can't run. You have such a spark about you. People can't see you on an audio tape, but they can certainly hear the smile in your voice and your aliveness. You know, what do you do to sharpen the saw at a physical level? What do you do to sharpen the saw at a spiritual level? What do you personally do?
What I do personally is get on a bike, a stationary life cycle.
Yes.
I get up at 5:30, and I watch inspirational television. I also, during that hour, read the scriptures.
Yes.
Prayerfully.
That's key, what you just said there. A lot of people read the scriptures, but they don't do it prayerfully.
and open. I think about it. I think what the scriptures mean for my day, this day. I go through that kind of affirmation of those 12 things, and I see the Savior that way, living those things. Then I remember when I have lived those things in my past. Then I anticipate how I can live those principles today.
So you every day recenter yourself, it sounds like.
Every day I have to. If I don't, you know, just like I go without a meal, I go without taking care of myself in any way, I start to suffer from it.
How many years have you been doing this?
I guess it's been about 25, 30 years.
Wow.
In fact, I was a professor when I was young. I guess I was about 22.
You're still pretty young.
Younger.
Yeah. 22 is when you started?
Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic. Tell me about your relationship with your wife.
Well,
she seems like she's a major part of it.
Oh, she's major. She is my counselor. I rely on her wisdom. She's got amazing wisdom. She can perceive things that I have no awareness of. I need her wisdom constantly. I never go a day that I don't have deep communication with her.
Yeah.
Last night, if you were to look at my phone bill, you'd see why. I mean, every night. Makes no difference. And if I'm home, we go on a Honda 90 trail cycle. An old one, we just putt around the neighborhood, no phones.
Yeah.
If it's bad weather, we get in a car. But she and God are the nurturing sources. I also attempt to keep in contact with each of those children on a consistent basis, including my married children and the grandchildren.
Yeah.
I see myself raising my great-grandchildren and my great-great-grandchildren. And I envision our 50th anniversary. We have with no empty chairs.
Yeah.
Everyone present.
Wow.
And Sandra and I see that together when we have our prayers together. I mean, you're getting me into a lot of more intimate personal stuff than I've ever gotten into.
I want people to know who you are. I think who you are is the ultimate model of your principles.
Right.
Someone could talk about it, but the reason I have so much love and respect for you is you live it. I look at you all
the time.
Well,
I try to.
I wish you had a camera on your face right now. I also, because I believe, I've met very few people who have had the kind of wisdom and balance and impact that you have had who have not had someone that they've shared their life with. How long have you been married? For how many years?
Well, I guess it's been about 37 years.
Wow. There's real success.
One last quote, maybe, that they might be interested in.
Yes.
Chardin. We are not human beings having a spiritual experience.
Yes.
We are spiritual beings having a human experience.
Yes.
Thanks to you, Tony.
God bless you.
And God bless you.